Hi, welcome to Muqaddimah, my name is Siavish. By the end of the 7th century CE, Arab Muslims ruled one of, if not the largest empire in the world. Their god, with a capital G, had delivered them a huge and diverse population that, frankly, they had no idea how to keep in check. For as long as the empire was expanding, it provided enough resources to keep everyone happy. But when it stopped expanding, it began to falter. A caliph was assassinated. A crisis of succession ensued, and a civil war tore the Muslims apart. All of that came to an end in the summer of 661 when Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan entered Kufa in southern Iraq, ending the bitter civil war and putting himself on the throne of the caliphate. He established the first dynasty of Islam, the Umayyad dynasty. This video is brought to you by, well, you guys. Thanks to my patrons for supporting the channel and making these videos possible. Al-Muqaddimah is funded only by Patreon, and as you can see, the videos take a long time to research, edit, and produce. And it's only because of my patrons that I am able to put this kind of time into these videos and keep them free from any kind of paywall. So if you want to pledge a dollar or more to support the channel, you can head over to my Patreon. Link is in the description. You can also become a member right here on YouTube. There's some cool stuff that comes with it. Back to the video. The Umayyads, or Banu Umayyah, were a subclan of the Quraysh and lived in Mecca, just like the Prophet's subclan, the Hashemites, or Banu Hashim. Banu simply means children of. According to Islamic tradition, they had been an influential family before Islam and strongly opposed Muhammad's teachings during the early years. Abu Sufyan, an Umayyad, had been the face of the rivalry between the Prophet and the Quraysh. Only a few members of the family converted before Prophet Muhammad's conquest of Mecca. One of them was Uthman ibn Affan, who was married to two of the daughters of the Prophet. Everyone else converted when Mecca fell in 630. This included the aforementioned Abu Sufyan and his two sons, Yazid and the future caliph Muawiyah, who was younger than 30 at the time, likely closer to 20. This seems like a conversion of convenience, if there ever was one. Though some sources put Muawiyah's conversion, being a secret one, 2 years earlier. While Muhammad and the Umayyads claimed descent from the same person, they did have another link, which was Abu Sufyan's daughter, Muawiyah's sister, Umm Habiba, who married Prophet Muhammad in 628, making Abu Sufyan Prophet Muhammad's father-in-law and Muawiyah his brother-in-law. After the conquest of Mecca and Quraysh's decisive submission to the Prophet, the Umayyads were redeemed by the Prophet, who allowed them to join his rank and used their skills and network to cultivate alliances with Arabian tribes. The Prophet himself passed away in 632, and immediately a rift appeared among the Muslims. Prophet Muhammad's close friend and senior companion, Abu Bakr, was chosen as caliph or successor to the Prophet. Some groups of Muslims weren't happy with this and wanted Ali, the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law, to become caliph instead. However, for now, Abu Bakr was caliph, and under him and his successor, Umar ibn al-Khattab, the Muslims invaded Palestine, Syria, Iraq, Persia, and Egypt. They went as far as Tunisia in the west and India in the east. It is here that the Umayyads entered the story of the caliphate. In 636, we see Muawiyah and his older brother Yazid commanding forces in Syria against the Byzantine Empire. In 637, we see him as a witness to the surrender of Jerusalem. Then in 639, he was besieging Caesarea, the capital of the Syria-Palestine province of the Byzantine Empire. Here, Muawiyah seems to be completely in charge compared to before when he was subordinate to his older brother Yazid. This was because Yazid had died in the plague of Amvas, which also took a large portion of the caliphate's army in Syria. The siege was exhaustive, and when Caesarea was finally taken, it was pillaged. Although archaeological evidence is less clear than tradition regarding Caesarea's fate. Whatever the case, it was rebuilt, but it never regained its importance. However, it left a permanent mark on Muawiyah. Since Caesarea was a port, it's possible that here Muawiyah saw the importance of a navy and later in his career would focus on building one. With the fall of Caesarea, military operations in Syria had pretty much come to an end, but the region was still volatile and the northern border was insecure. The caliph, back in Medina, needed someone to keep it together. This responsibility fell to Muawiyah by accident.
At the start of 639, the most senior commander in Syria was Abu Ubaidah ibn al-Jarrah. Unfortunately, he passed away from the plague. His office fell to Yazid, Muawiyah's brother, who was respected by the military, though he died shortly after as well. Muawiyah was now the most senior commander in Syria. Caliph Umar doesn't seem to have been happy about this, but there was no other candidate whom the military respected, and so Muawiyah would have to do. Whatever Umar's feelings might have been towards Muawiyah, he was assassinated in 644. The next caliph, Uthman, was himself an Umayyad. He was second cousin to Muawiyah, so he confirmed Muawiyah as the governor of Syria. Uthman was a respected companion of the Prophet. Not only was he an early convert, he had also been married to two of the Prophet's daughters. However, his policies as caliph weren't popular. He was trying to bring the empire under a centralized government, and the way he did that was by appointing people he trusted. As it turns out, most of them were his close relatives. Umayyads were certainly not seen as the most pious Muslims because of their opposition to the Prophet, and so seeing so many Umayyads in power made many people very angry. Meanwhile, Muawiyah was serving as the governor of four provinces: Syria, Palestine, Jordan, and Homs. He was even appointed as governor of Iraq after a few years. Muawiyah was really effective as a governor. He stabilized the region, and while he didn't pursue great conquests or battles, he did keep pressure on the Byzantine Empire. He even retook some key port cities that had been lost to the Byzantines during the confusion following Umar's assassination. While he didn't have much of a hard time securing the northern border, he did have trouble with coastal cities, which were easier for Constantinople to attack. So only a year or two after being appointed, Muawiyah began aggressively pursuing the construction of a navy. He had tried this under Umar II, but Umar had ordered him not to focus on a navy. Uthman had allowed him, and so by 648, Muawiyah had a fleet up and running. The next year, Muawiyah attacked Cyprus. He fell back after taking a tribute from them, but attacked again the next year after a violation of the treaty and finally conquered it. He even raided as far as Rhodes, but didn't conquer it during his tenure as governor. In 655 came the Battle of the Masts. Off the coast of western Anatolia, some 500 Byzantine ships clashed with an equally large or slightly smaller Muslim fleet. The Byzantine fleet was being commanded personally by Emperor Constans, while we're not sure if Muawiyah was present with his fleet. It's also possible that the Muslim fleet was made up of a Syrian fleet and an Egyptian fleet. Whatever the case, it was a disaster for the Byzantines. The emperor himself was barely able to get away with his life. The dominance of the Byzantine Empire on the eastern Mediterranean was over, and the road to Constantinople was open. On land, he expanded the caliphate's control into Armenia, which wasn't exactly conquered but rather just installed as a client state. The commander of that army was a man named Habib ibn Maslama al-Fihri, who would become Muawiyah's most trusted general in the coming years. Muawiyah was able to build so much power in Syria and rack up successes because he had something that no other Muslim governor did: the loyalty of the locals. Syria had many Christian Arab tribes, which Muawiyah employed in his military and rewarded generously. They had been especially useful in the navy because Arabs from Arabia didn't know how to sail. Muawiyah even married a Christian woman from the Banu Kalb tribe to secure an alliance with them. Her name was Maysoon bint Bahtal, and she was a poetess. She came from the desert and didn't enjoy living with Muawiyah in the palaces. A lot of her poetry was about missing her homeland. With the support of these tribes, Muawiyah was powerful enough to even challenge the caliph. However, he was quite loyal to Uthman, who was, after all, his cousin. Unfortunately, he was the only one. By the early 650s, there was discontent among many vassals of the caliph who resented the amount of power Umayyads had accumulated under Uthman. Now, there are various versions of what happened next. We know for sure that there was a mutiny against Uthman in which he was assassinated in his home in 656, but the details vary from person to person. Even the names of the assassins change depending on who's telling the story. Muawiyah's role in this affair is no different. Some sources paint him in favorable light. They tell us that he dispatched an army to protect the caliph, but he was too late and the news of the assassination reached him before the army was out of Syria. Other sources paint him in negative light. telling us that Muawiyah deliberately tried to exploit the situation to his benefit. According to some, he did so through inaction, and according to others, he actively misguided the caliph and practically doomed him. The truth is quite difficult to ascertain, as Stephen Humphreys writes. Whatever Muawiyah did or did not do during the mutiny, he now faced a crisis of his own. His response displayed all the qualities for which he became famous, allowing a situation to ripen before committing himself to a course of action, concealing his own motives and purposes from public scrutiny, long-term planning combined with a capacity to seize unexpected opportunities, a patient seeking for allies even as he relentlessly undermined loyalties among the supporters of his opponents, and a willingness to be perfectly ruthless at critical moments. The sources disagree on many things, but on this portrait, they are of one mind. In any case, Uthman was assassinated. For the second time in just 24 years, there was a crisis of succession in the caliphate. For the mutineers, there was only one candidate to succeed Uthman. That candidate was Ali ibn Abi Talib, the cousin and son-in-law of the Prophet. There was certainly a case to be made for him. He was the head of the Prophet's house and he had been an early convert. He was the father of the Prophet's only male descendants, Hassan and Hussein. He was also considered a pious and devoted Muslim who would lead the community in the path laid down by the Prophet. While Ali was young when the caliph passed away, he was in his 50s by now. He had been passed over for the caliphate thrice, but now it was his time. However, Ali wasn't a political figure at all. He had mostly been absent from leadership roles up to this point. He had never led an army. His role during the mutiny is also debated. According to some sources, he had left Medina, but according to others, he, along with his sons, were guarding Uthman's house in respect for his office. The mutineers offered the caliphate to Ali, who accepted and thus became the fourth caliph of the Rashidun, the rightly guided. This was contentious, to say the least. The Umayyads, who held considerable power, objected to Ali accepting the caliphate. Their argument was that the blood of a caliph couldn't determine the election. By accepting, Ali was admitting that what the mutineers had done was justified. By accepting, Ali was complicit after the fact in the assassination of Uthman. Credibility was lent to this argument by the fact that the Umayyads asked for retribution for Uthman's assassination, but Ali protected the assassins. Muawiyah wasn't very vocal in the process. So far, the only thing he had done was not swear allegiance to Ali. However, another faction appeared in opposition to Ali. This was led by Aisha, the Prophet's wife, Zubair ibn al-Awwam, the Prophet's nephew through marriage, and Talha ibn Ubaidullah, a senior companion of the Prophet. All three of them had been critical of Uthman's policies, but here they claimed to be against Ali's disregard for justice for Uthman. They went to Iraq and raised an army. Ali did the same and met them in the Battle of the Camel in 656. Both Zubair and Talha were killed during the battle and Aisha was captured. She was forced into a retirement in Medina, where she lived for the rest of her days, away from the political arena. By winning this battle, Ali had proven himself and had hence secured Iraq and Arabia. The only parts of the caliphate that he didn't have were Syria and Egypt. We don't know what Ali and Muawiyah were thinking. Maybe Muawiyah just wanted to be confirmed as governor. Maybe Ali just didn't want to seem weak by accepting terms of allegiance from Muawiyah, a subordinate. In any case, Ali marched from Kufa to attack Syria. Muawiyah gathered his forces and prepared to meet Ali in the battlefield. According to some sources, Muawiyah was sent the bloody shirt of Uthman, which he hung in the mosque and used to inspire his troops. The two armies met in 657 in the Battle of Siffin. We don't know the details of the battle because there are a lot of things added later to the narrative that don't seem plausible. According to one story, Ali was winning, but Muawiyah had his troops tie pages from the Quran to their lances. This forced Ali's troops to stop attacking. This is almost certainly a colorful detail meant to exaggerate the differences between the two sides. According to Christian sources, though, it seems Muawiyah had the upper hand in the battle, which frankly makes more sense because the battle took place in Syria and Muawiyah's troops were Syrian nomads, who usually do better against settled tribes such as the ones in Ali's army. Whatever the case, the battle was likely a stalemate. However, there was so much bloodshed that both sides were shocked and agreed to negotiate. Again, the details of the negotiation changed from person to person. They certainly weren't able to achieve anything, and different sources blame either Muawiyah or Ali for this. One thing we know for sure is that Ali's position was weakened by this, especially in the eyes of his more puritanical supporters. They believed that Muawiyah had rebelled against a sitting caliph, and so he had to be fought until he was defeated and punished. By negotiating, they believed Ali had obstructed justice. They left Ali's side and formed a third side known as the Khawarij, those who left. Khawarij or Kharijites would become sort of the dirty word of Islamic history, where it was and still is applied arbitrarily to whomever one was fighting at a given time. The Khawarij maintained that only as long as the caliph was pious, a term that was defined by them, could he remain caliph. If he isn't pious anymore, he can be removed by force. Ali tried to make peace with them, but it didn't work out, and in 658, he defeated them in the Battle of Nahrawan, although they weren't completely broken. While Ali was busy with them, Muawiyah was able to install one of his men as the governor of Egypt, which extended his control from Syria to Egypt, while Ali's control was eroding. This gave Muawiyah the confidence to declare himself caliph in 660. This far, he hadn't made any claims to the caliphate. His struggle, he claimed, was only to get justice for his cousin, but now he had taken this bold step. He coronated himself in Jerusalem. He even visited the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Church of Saint Mary. This was probably done to win over the Christians, who were the vast majority of the population in Syria. The next year, in 661, Ali was stabbed in the Great Mosque of Kufa by a Kharijite assassin. There are some sources that claim that there was a plot to assassinate both Ali and Muawiyah, but Muawiyah's assassin was caught. This makes sense because we know that Muawiyah kept personal guards while Ali didn't. Muawiyah, however, hadn't won yet. Ali's son and successor, Hassan, still had a claim. Muawiyah simply struck a deal with him. Once again, the details of the deal are different depending on who you ask. At the end of the day, Muawiyah was now the sole ruler of the Islamic world. His rule would go for 20 years, and in those 20 years, Caliph Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan would define what it means to rule in the Islamic world. Unfortunately, the sources on Muawiyah's reign as caliph aren't as plentiful as the ones about the civil war. So it's difficult to draw a chronology of his reign year by year, but we can draw some major points of his reign. Also, it could be because his reign seems to have been largely calm and without any major disturbances within the caliphate. Anyhow, having just come out of a brutal and bloody civil war, it was important for Muawiyah to reconcile the different sides of the caliphate. The most important was Iraq. Iraq was fertile and rich, and it had sided with Ali, and so it had to be brought around. Muawiyah visited Kufa in 661 and appointed a new governor. This governor, Al-Mughira ibn Shuba al-Tahakfi, was a companion of the Prophet and had previously governed this region and was a good choice. Muawiyah gave Iraqi tribes autonomy as long as they promised to not cause trouble. Muawiyah also gave Al-Mughira the task of eliminating, or at least keeping, the Kharijites at bay. Ali had nearly wiped them out before he was assassinated, but there were still some around. The Kharijites themselves claimed a caliphate for their leader, Al-Mustafrid, but due to their rigid our way or death approach, they couldn't win many supporters. At their peak in 663, they had around 300 people. In 664, Muawiyah's army was able to defeat them and kill Al-Mustafrid. Another problem was Basra. Unlike Kufa, it hadn't sided with anyone and had just fallen into anarchy during the civil war. Muawiyah installed Ziyad ibn Sumayyah, whose mother was a prostitute, as Basra's governor. He had also supported Ali during the war. Ziyad, with his suspect parentage, wasn't popular and was known as Ziyad ibn Abihi, Ziyad the son of his father. Muawiyah claimed that Ziyad was his own brother. He claimed that his father, Abu Sufyan, had fathered him out of wedlock in pre-Islamic times. Hence, Muawiyah was able to install his new brother as governor. This shows how Muawiyah valued talent over lineage and personal hostility. Ziyad is considered a great administrator and an even greater speaker. His inaugural sermon in Basra is often held up as an example of Arabic eloquence. He was given the province of Kufa as well in 668 when Al-Mughira passed away. Eventually, Ziyad became the viceroy of the East, ruling Iraq and Iran and becoming ridiculously rich and powerful. He was to Muawiyah what Muawiyah had been to Uthman. However, due to his humble ancestry, he couldn't even dream of overthrowing Muawiyah, and so he remained loyal. When Muawiyah came to power, nearly 30 years had passed since the death of the Prophet. From those 30 years, 5 had been of open civil war. Before that, Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman hadn't ruled much. They had sent armies to conquer territory, and then they had taxed those territories. Central government was weak, and it wasn't uncommon that governors refused orders from the caliph. You can also get an idea from the fact that this empire that Muawiyah ruled was previously divided between the Sassanids and the Byzantines, who had been fighting each other for a century. There were a dozen religious denominations and even more languages. On top of that, the Arab Muslim elites only made up something like 5% of the population. This was obviously a very difficult empire to rule. Muawiyah didn't try to impose anything on them because he didn't want to stir the pot too much. He ruled indirectly by delegating to governors. He knew he couldn't control everything from his capital at Damascus, and so he tried to make peace with everyone by giving them autonomy and accepting tribute in return. Of course, finding loyal governors would have been a challenge, but he could always rely on his own Umayyads and the Banu Kalb. To some, Muawiyah was an overlord who respected his clients. To others, he was a brutal tyrant. Here too, he used his political ability more than the fear of the military. He made sure that the people he couldn't win over were too weak to do something about it. This included the people who'd supported Ali, as well as the Meccans, who saw the Umayyads as being the old rivals of the Prophet. He also moved the populations of entire towns in order to secure cities that might cause trouble in the future. He probably gave or approved major policies, for instance expansion campaigns, but they were executed by his governors. The empire did expand in the west, particularly in North Africa, where it almost reached the Atlantic. But the region wasn't consolidated till a few decades after Muawiyah's death. In terms of the empire's economy, Muawiyah again didn't interfere much. Provinces were free to do what they had been doing for centuries. This meant Greek systems in Egypt and Persian ones in Iran. This included coinage. He minted coins, and early on he might have even tried to create his own Islamic style, but those coins were rejected by the people, and so he went back to copying coins from the Byzantine and the Sassanid empires. Only a small part of the revenue went to Damascus from the provinces because they had to pay their own expenses. Muawiyah doesn't seem to have used this money for traditional monarch stuff like palaces and tombs. Rather, he used most of it to keep the tribes in Syria happy. Speaking of Syria, the vast majority of the people there were Christians. Muawiyah employed many of them without much bias based on faith. This included the grandfather of John of Damascus, Mansur ibn Sarjun. Almost all contemporary and near-contemporary Christian sources applaud Muawiyah's reign. However, he didn't fund any churches or bishoprics, with a few exceptions here and there. That could be because nomadic Christian tribes, whom Muawiyah relied on, didn't have churches, and city folk, who had churches, he didn't really need. Although he does seem to have tried to cultivate an image as the new protector of the Christian church, since the Byzantine emperor, he claimed, had failed. Speaking of the Byzantine Empire, Muawiyah didn't aggressively pursue a policy of expansion. However, he did send regular campaigns into Anatolia, but they were mostly to raid and to keep his men busy. Still, he was able to harass the Byzantines so much that a lot of central Anatolia was no man's land. His naval campaigns, however, seem to have been a more serious issue. Archaeological evidence suggests that many cities on the Aegean coast of Anatolia were abandoned, so there seems to have been quite a bit of destruction involved. Whatever the intention of these campaigns, they did serve Muawiyah when he decided to attack Constantinople. With the interior in ruins, the caliph could send a fleet for Constantinople without fear of reinforcements. He did that in 674 under the command of his son and future caliph Yazid. Although there's some debate about whether it was one campaign or two, with one taking place in 669. The first Islamic siege of Constantinople is currently being re-evaluated and should be revisited in a future video. From 674 to 678, Constantinople was blockaded by Muawiyah's fleet. Eventually, the Byzantines found an opening and attacked the besiegers through both land and sea. They used Greek fire, which resulted in the fleet's devastation. While spectacular, this setback was relatively minor for Muawiyah. However, he never tried to take Constantinople again. Muawiyah didn't build many palaces or tombs. There was a palace in Damascus which was so humble that a Byzantine envoy commented that the ceiling will do for the birds and the walls will do for the rats. There were probably some forts built in the Syrian desert where he met tribal leaders from time to time. Also, he built a dam near the town of Taif in Hijaz that is the only archaeological remain of his reign. While Muawiyah didn't build many monuments, he did build an empire. The entity he inherited was a caliphate. According to Muslim tradition and popular imagination, this was a golden state. It was a time of justice under the great companions of the Prophet. The caliphs followed Islam and the law of God was everywhere. Unfortunately, the reality wasn't exactly that. Controlling the caliphate from Medina proved to be a challenge. Umar, for example, lauded for his conquests, didn't really have control of his armies. Commanders did ignore his orders here and there. Fortunately, he was respected, and so this was rare. Also, the early caliphs didn't have personal guards to make themselves more open to public. Unfortunately, 3 out of 4 of them got assassinated, so Muawiyah did keep personal guards. The first step that Muawiyah took as caliph was to move the capital to Damascus. He had already used it as his base for nearly 20 years as Syria's governor. Damascus was linked to the legacy of the Byzantine Empire more than it was to Islam. However, in many ways, as a leader, Muawiyah was not that different from the Prophet himself. He served as a bridge between the old world and the new. The caliphate was only sustainable for as long as it was expanding because the army and the commanders could be paid through loot. When the expansion slowed down, the empire needed real revenue, and for that, it needed control over its governors. While respect worked for Umar, not everyone had that working in their favor. Just look at Uthman. Muawiyah was able to pull off a ridiculously complicated balancing act and build a house of cards. Unfortunately, he balanced it on his palm, and without his particular style, the empire wouldn't last long. I think I'm in pretty good company when I say that what Muawiyah did here was inevitable. After all, Ibn Khaldun, the man behind the other Al-Muqaddimah, also maintained that it was inevitable. He writes, "Even though Ali was in the right, Muawiyah's intentions were not evil, for he aimed at the truth but missed it. Each was right insofar as his intentions were concerned. The nature of kingship requires that one person claim all glory for himself and appropriate it to himself alone. It was not for Muawiyah to deny this to himself and his kinsmen. Kingship was a natural thing that communal solidarity, by its very nature, brought in its train. His Umayyad kingsmen and their followers banded together and were willing to die for him. Had Muawiyah tried to lead them onto another course of action, had he opposed them and not claimed all the power for himself and them, it would have meant the dissolution of the whole regime that he had consolidated. Solomon and his father David had the kingship of the Israelites for themselves, as the nature of kingship demands, and it is well known how great a share of prophethood and truth they possessed. Likewise, Muawiyah named Yazid as his successor because he was afraid of the dissolution of his regime. Inasmuch as the Umayyads did not want to see power surrendered to anyone else. Had Muawiyah named anyone else as his successor, the Umayyads would have been against him. Moreover, they had a good opinion of Yazid. Muawiyah would not have been the man to name Yazid his successor had he believed him to be really so wicked. Such an assumption must be absolutely excluded in Muawiyah's case." So, to reiterate, Muawiyah didn't take the caliphate anywhere it wasn't going. He just found the least bloody path to get there. A lot of things about Muawiyah and most other people from the first century of Islam are tough to tell without relying on anecdotes from tradition. Fortunately, many of the anecdotes about Muawiyah from different sources are consistent about his personality, so perhaps they hold some truth. I think one anecdote from Al-Balathuri presents his personality very nicely. In this story, Muawiyah receives a letter from Ibn Zubayr, whose father had fought against Ali in the Battle of the Camel. Muawiyah and Ibn Zubayr had adjacent properties and there was some sort of dispute. Ibn Zubayr wrote a letter to Muawiyah in which he insulted him. Muawiyah showed the letter to his son, Yazid, and asked him what he would do. Yazid, being a hothead, recommended arresting and executing him. Muawiyah pointed out that Ibn Zubayr had sons and brothers who'd protect him, so he'd have to send a decent amount of men to arrest him. If he paid each man 1,000 dirhams, he would spend at least 100,000 dirhams on arresting one man. Gifting the land was a much cheaper option and it would win him a friend, so that's what he did. He gave the land to Ibn Zubayr. This anecdote shows Muawiyah as a calm and reasonable person who wasn't quick to anger and always weighed his options. He also won a lot of friends through gifts. A lot of anecdotes about Muawiyah are about him interacting with his son Yazid. These are meant to show Yazid as the polar opposite of Muawiyah. Muawiyah received a lot of criticism from people who thought that they were better Muslims than him. He never said anything about them. Muawiyah is said to have told his son that a pietist's insults might sting, but he would pose no threat if he were ignored. Punishment would make him a martyr and a rallying point for the discontented. Better to leave him as a voice crying in the wilderness. This is a lesson that Yazid would clearly ignore. His religious beliefs often come under fire from people as they did in his day. Obviously, we don't know what kind of a man he was in that regard. Some call him a secret Christian because he was really close to them. But he always seems to have stuck to the bigger points of Islam. He is also said to have said that wives of noblemen dominate them while base men dominate their wives. These anecdotes could be fictional and likely are, but still quite interesting. The great Amir al-Mu'mineen, Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan, passed away in April of 680 after 19 years in office. He was succeeded by his son Yazid. This is, to this date, the worst thing about Muawiyah's reign. This is considered the last step in Muawiyah turning the caliphate, whatever that means, into an empire, whatever that means. Yazid is today one of, if not the most hated figure in the history of Islam. Okay. Now I'm gonna be an absolute mad lad and try to justify or at least explain this decision. Keep in mind that religiously, I'm strongly opposed to everything that Yazid was as a person and as a tyrant. However, let's look at this not from a religious lens, but rather from a historical lens. This is a history channel after all. I'm not going to talk about what kind of a caliph Yazid would turn out to be, only why Muawiyah chose him. Now, Muawiyah had other sons, but they were young and Yazid was the oldest. Also, Yazid was the son of Maysun bint Bahdal and so he had the support of most Syrian tribes. Yazid was also a decent commander. We know that he played a role in the siege of Constantinople. However, the failure there wasn't exactly his fault. All the sources that were written decades after Yazid mention him negatively as a decadent and indulgent prince, but we don't have any contemporary or near-contemporary sources that talk about his personal life. So it's tough to get an idea of what kind of a person he was. The other two candidates that people usually put on the list are Abdullah ibn Zubayr and Husayn ibn Ali. Both of them were sons of Muawiyah's rivals, so of course Muawiyah's supporters would never have supported either of them. Neither of them had powerful allies, and it's likely that the empire would have been split between the two and another civil war would have taken place. Perhaps Muawiyah's decision was merely to save the caliphate from another war, although another war would find its way to the caliphate's doors. There was no real succession system in the caliphate. The first caliph had been elected in a small informal gathering of senior companions. The second wasn't even elected because he was the only real candidate. For the third, we hear that there was a small electoral body of six companions. By Muawiyah's death, a majority of the companions had passed away. The ones that were left were either too old to be politically influential or too young to remember much of the Prophet's time. A council at that time would likely be made up of Muawiyah's governors and they most likely would have picked Yazid too. So again, Muawiyah didn't take the caliphate anywhere it wasn't going. He just found the least bloody path to get there. We will talk about Yazid's reign in a future video, but for now, let's return to Muawiyah. At the end of the day, Muawiyah is a complicated figure. He's not just a part of Islamic history, but he's also a part of the history of Islam. What I mean by that is that he'll always be judged by different standards than most people in Islamic history. For Shias, he'll always be the corrupt absolutist tyrant who stood up against their beloved Imam Ali. He fought him and then, according to them, poisoned his son Hassan. For Sunnis, he'll always be the man who turned the caliphate into an empire and put his son on the throne. The son who eventually assassinated the grandson of the Prophet very brutally. There's simply no excuse or justification that is enough. Also, he was too nice to Christians for a lot of Orthodox Muslims to be comfortable with. Not only are moral standards different here, but all sides even have their own versions of events. So there's no way to argue for a historical Muawiyah in a religious context. There's also a lot of stuff about him having persecuted the descendants of the Prophet, but the sources there are really muddled because they were written under the Abbasids who destroyed the Umayyads, so we cannot verify them. They're also very religiously charged, and so I didn't get into any of that. However, when we step out of religion and we see Muawiyah as a human being in the real world, we see a man whose influence on the Islamic world is immeasurable. Here's a man who took an empire that had been itching to break apart since the death of the Prophet. It was a very diverse empire, so what worked for one faction couldn't work for another. Not only did he manage to rule this empire, but he also kept it together without any major rebellions, and he made it a formidable force that matched the great Byzantine Empire over land and sea. There's no guarantee that Ali, who was, without a doubt, a more pious Muslim and a closer companion of the Prophet, could have managed this. After all, during the civil war, Ali had trouble managing his allies while Muawiyah didn't even break a sweat. By the civil war, Muawiyah had 20 years of experience in warfare and governance, while Ali had none, as Chase Robinson writes. By every reasonable standard, Muawiyah's near 20-year reign had been a nearly unqualified success. Not only is he grudgingly praised by Islamic sources, but he enjoys quite exceptional praise among Christian sources, who sometimes speak of his reign as a time of peace and prosperity. When justice flourished and there was great peace in the regions under his control, as one 7th century Christian writing in northern Iraq puts it. The secret of his success seems to have been laissez-faire patrimonialism rather than robust state building. He may have thrown up a palace or two, and he may even have dabbled a bit in striking some coins, but instead of forging powerful instruments of rule, such as a salaried army and robust tax administration, he relied upon his own wit, the council and the pull of tribal chiefs, and the remnants of the Byzantine and Sasanian fiscal systems. The Arabs had entered a world more civilized than their own, one scholar has written, and since they came not to destroy but to exploit, it was more reasonable to use a machinery already well adapted to that purpose than to try and replace it at once by something else. Nor did Muawiyah vigorously project Islam as a legitimizing ideology of rule. He may not have been a reconstructed pre-Islamic sheikh, but his was a politics of persuasion, and he was at his most persuasive when speaking in the sheikhly idiom that he had learned in pre-Islamic Mecca. Lacking both the good luck and sound judgment of their father, Muawiyah's two sons had virtually no resources to fall back upon when their father died. The small polity was not robust enough to save the dynasty occupying it. When Muawiyah died, his polity died with him. Other empires that expanded with as much speed as the caliphate had, such as the Mongol Empire and Alexander's Empire, fell apart shortly after their deaths, but Muawiyah saved the Islamic caliphate from sharing that fate. Without him, it's likely that Iran would have fallen to local powers who would have fallen to the Turks. As we have seen, Muslims made up less than around 5% of the population, so likely these local powers and Turks wouldn't have been Muslims. Seeing how history turned out, they would have easily conquered Greater Syria. Islam could have easily been pushed into Arabia. Of course, that's just my guesswork and my opinion, and you don't have to agree with it, but it's true that Muawiyah was a man of remarkable abilities. He deserves to be judged by different standards, and his contributions to the Islamic world need to be re-evaluated. He should be remembered for the incredibly gifted ruler that he was, Caliph Muawiyah the Great. See you next time. Don't forget to subscribe and press the bell icon. On the screen right now, you can see the names and tiers of the patrons. You can join them by pledging a dollar or more to support the channel. Thank you for watching.